Gods to what I think is going to be the cutest episode yet of Myths and Muses, a Plato Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Cass, daughter of Cleo, the Muse of History, and today we're going to be talking about pets. Why do the Muses want me to talk about pets? Well, whether it's dogs, cats, birds, fish, lizards, all kinds of pets today are a frequent inspiration for arts of all kinds, whether it's Instagram photos or movies like The Secret Life of Pets or the Air Bud franchise. And that's always been true. As long as humans have had pets, we've wanted to work them into the stories we tell. One of the most famous pets in mythology is one who also has a very important job. Cerberus, the three-headed hound of Hades who guards the gates of the underworld. Cerberus is the child of the monsters Echidna and Typhon, and in addition to three heads, he also has a serpent's tail, or in some depictions, a tail that actually is a full serpent. Cerberus appears in many myths when the hero has to travel to the underworld. He is the literal guardian at the gates, who will prevent them from going further unless they can appease or trick him. In the Aeneid, the Sibyl who accompanies Aeneas to the underworld comes prepared with a loaf of honey cake laced with special herbs that put the pup to sleep. Orpheus, on the other hand, charms Cerberus with his song on his way down to find Eurydice. Cerberus features most prominently in the story of Heracles' 12 labors. Heracles' cousin Eurystheus, who had been setting him all the tasks, told Heracles to fetch Cerberus from the underworld. Not because he particularly wanted Cerberus, but because he thought the task would be impossible and the death of Heracles. But Heracles went directly to Hades and asked if he could borrow the dog. Hades agreed, as long as Heracles could subdue Cerberus without using weapons. He didn't want his pup hurt after all. Heracles manages to get Cerberus in a headlock, which I have a lot of logistical questions about how you do that to a creature with multiple heads. But I guess that's why Heracles is a legendary hero. Once he subdues the dog, he leads him up to the surface. In some other versions of the story, though, Heracles just asks Persephone, and she says, sure, as long as you bring him back. In those tales, Heracles is able to do that because he has previously been initiated into the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is part of the cult of Demeter and Persephone. So he had an in. Either way, once Eurystheus catches sight of the three-headed dog, he becomes so terrified that he hides, ordering Heracles to put that thing back where it came from, which Heracles does. Cerberus returns home and to his usual role as guardian of the gates. Oh, that's Aunt Polly, Polyhymnia, Muse of Sacred Poetry, who wants me to correct a common misconception about Cerberus's name. You may have heard it said, or read it somewhere on the internet, that Cerberus means spotted. As charming as it is to think that Hades may have given his dog a name as homey and, well, normal as Spot, it probably isn't true. People who study language aren't entirely sure what Cerberus means, but it may be related to some Phoenician words that mean hound of the earth. Considering he's a hound who lives under the earth, I think that makes some sense. Cerberus isn't the only pupper keeping the dead in line, though. A similar role is filled by Garm in Norse mythology. Garm guards Helheim, and as such is closely associated with the goddess Hel, although no less a god than Odin called Garm the best of hounds. Like Cerberus, he stops the souls of the dead from leaving and stops the souls of the living from getting in. When Ragnarok comes, however, Garm will break free of his chains and leave Helheim, an act signifying the collapse of order in the worlds. Tyr, the god of order and justice, will try to wrangle him back, and each will kill the other in battle. In Aztec tradition, a dog fills the role of Psychopomp. That's a god responsible for leading the souls of the dead to the underworld. Xolotl accompanied Quetzalcoatl to Mictlan, the land of the dead, to retrieve the bones from those who inhabited the previous world to create new life for the present world. Now, as personification of the evening star, Xolotl is tasked with protecting the sun from the dangers of the underworld. His presence ensures that the sun will not die and will return to the earth in the morning. Good dog. In Celtic mythology, the spectral dogs called the Cunanun are considered heralds of death rather than guardians of the dead. These pups get their name from where they live, Anun, the fairy otherworld. Under the direction of Arun, the lord of Anun, they participate in the Wild Hunt, a supernatural chase. Sometimes the hunt is an act of protection for the mortal world, ensuring that spirits and dead souls do not trouble the living. But sometimes it's a danger to mortals, who may either be the object of the chase, yikes, or who may get pulled from their sleep to join the hunters. Hearing the howl of the Cún Anún is thus taken as a bad omen. The Cún Anún are generally white with red ears. White animals in Celtic lore are often associated with the other world, while red is the Celtic color of death. Oh, Mom wants me to say a little bit about why dogs seem to feature in so many mythological tales. I think it says a lot about their relationship to humanity. Dogs are the first animals that humans domesticated at least 15,000 years ago, and maybe even longer. Genetic analysis suggests that dogs and wolves split off from a common ancestor as much as 40,000 years ago. That's a lot of very good boys and girls over history. It wasn't until a few thousand years after that, more around 10,000 years ago, that we started domesticating goats, sheep, cattle, horses, and cats. Those other animals often play important roles in mythology too, though. Consider Norse mythology, where some of the gods have animals other than horses pulling their chariots, like Freya's cats and Thor's goats. And there's Aunt Terpsichore telling me that she's being helpful today. That's... okay, well, I'm not going to question it if she's so inclined. She says she's actually set up this episode's interview for me. Wow, thanks, Aunt T. That's super great. With a hellhound. Aunt Terpsichore set up an interview with a hellhound. Okay. Okay. Well, always happy for this podcast to be breaking new ground, and this would definitely seem to qualify. Okay, she sent instructions to connect us. Oh, and she sent an obsidian mirror. Yeah, that tracks as a way to reach a hellhound, I guess. I can't see them using iris messages. Honestly, I'm just glad she didn't decide to drop the hellhound in the center of my office. There would not be room for it. Okay, let's see here. How do I activate this mirror? Oh, okay, it worked. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Please, introduce yourself. Listeners, we are most honored to welcome to the podcast today, She Who Gnaws Upon the Bones of the Wicked. But you prefer to be known as Chompy. Excellent. Great. Welcome, Chompy. Please, tell us a little about what it's like to be a hellhound. Yes, I can see how being the child of Nyx and Cerberus could put a lot of pressure on you. And working for your dad in Hades, yeah, I mean, it's always hard to go into the family business. It's good to hear that you're devoted to it nonetheless, though. I mean, sure, sometimes the things we love can still be a struggle. So tell me, what's your favorite part of being a hellhound? The snacks. I'm a little afraid to ask. And playing with your litter mates. Aw, well, that's sweet. It's always great when... playing with them by chasing down the souls of the unrighteous and... okay, no, I don't think I need to translate the rest of those details for our audience. Suffice it to say, listeners, that Chompy here enjoys her work. Okay. Chompy, I am just so impressed by your beautiful flame tail there. How do you keep it so flamey? Regular grooming with an iron poker and liberal applications of lighter fluid and brimstone. That's a great beauty routine. I love it. That's wonderful. That's illuminating. Well, I don't want to keep you from your very important work helping out your dad. Thank you, Chompy, for your insights into life in the underworld. It's been a real special experience. Okay, that was unique. Oh, okay. Here's another text from Mom, who wants me to talk a little about how myths and legends can reflect the roles that pets played in the lives of the people who told those stories. Oh, fantastic. One really great example of that, the cats of ancient Egypt. You may have heard that the Egyptians worshipped their cats, and that's not exactly true. Cats were instead considered vessels that the gods liked to take the form of. Most famous of these is Bastet, the cat-headed goddess who was a protector of the family. She kept the family, especially women and children, safe from disease, and she also played a role in the journey to the afterlife. Bastet was one of the most important deities in the Egyptian pantheon, and the festivals at her temple in Bubastis drew worshippers by the thousands. Why were cats so important to the ancient Egyptians? It had a lot to do with the cat's role as a hunter. They kept Egypt's granaries free of mice and other vermin, and they also killed the snakes and scorpions so feared by the Egyptians. As a result, Egyptian cats were pampered and beloved. Bringing harm to a cat was a serious crime and could be punishable by death. Which, yeah, fair. Many cats were mummified upon their deaths, giving them the same preparation for eternity that humans got. And that's a pretty big deal. In one great example, Prince Thutmose, around the year 1350 BCE, created a magnificent tomb for his precious feline companion, complete with a limestone sarcophagus. The art in the tomb shows her dressed in golden jewelry and eating off the prince's plate. And the inscription on her sarcophagus proclaims, "I myself am placed among the imperishable ones that are in the sky, for I am Ta Miu, the triumphant." Isn't that great? I'm going to start giving all my pets epithets like the triumphant. Demigods, how would you describe your pets? The magnificent? The wondrous? Swift-footed like Achilles or wily like Odysseus? Or maybe they need an epithet that describes their role in your household, like eater of shoes or terror of squirrels. Oh! Aunt Mel Pomini has sent me a note about the role that a cat plays in... Of course... A tragic story in The Tale of Genji. The Tale of Genji is a Japanese work of literature, sometimes considered the world's first novel. It was written in the early 11th century by the noblewoman Murasaki Shikibu. The story follows Hikaru Genji, the son of an emperor who gets demoted and has to work his way back up through the ranks of the Japanese military. But the real focus of the story is on his romances. A cat unwittingly sets off tragedy in one of those romances. This particular feline was the pet of a princess whom Genji married. One day, it ran out of her house, and she chased after it. She was then seen by Kashiwaji, son of Genji's best friend, who falls in love with her. Kashiwaji and Genji's wife then have a secret relationship, but Kashiwaji feels so guilty about it that he falls ill and dies. So that's not great. Thanks, Aunt Mel, as always, for bumming us out. But it does show how cats were a very common part of Japanese life. You can see them in lots of different artwork across many eras. I'll put some in the show notes. And cats continue to play an important role in Japanese society today. The maneki neko, or beckoning cat, is a symbol of good fortune. Many shops, restaurants, and other businesses have a figurine of the maneki neko, which usually looks like a calico Japanese bobtail with one paw raised. You can see some pictures of those in the show notes too. Why is the maneki neko good luck? Japanese folklore gives us a few different reasons. In some stories, they are cats born in Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines. In a tale from the Edo period, a party of travelers followed a calico cat to a temple, and as soon as they got there, a horrible, destructive storm broke out. The cat had led them to shelter, so no one was harmed, and forever after, those travelers honored such felines. There are several other stories like that, including one where the cat's sudden appearance actually changes the course of a war. But there's also a much humbler story, where an impoverished shopkeeper adopts a cat, despite barely being able to feed himself. The cat, in gratitude, sat at his doorway, and she was so beautiful that she drew passersby to his shop, where they began to spend lots of money. I like that story a lot, because it shows how kindness and compassion can be rewarded in surprising ways. Demigods, have you ever rescued an animal? If you've got a great story about being a hero to an animal, we would love to hear it. Leave us a comment or use the link in the show notes with Immortal Guardian's permission. The importance of pets in everyday life is also reflected in the tale of the Irish hero, Cuculain. His name literally means the Hound of Cuculain. But that's not actually the name that Cuculain was born with. His mother called him Setanta. When he was a child, a smith called Cuculain invited Setanta's uncle, Concobar, to dinner. On his way there, Concobar saw Setanta playing with some other boys, and he was so impressed with Setanta's athleticism that he invited the boy to come to dinner with him. Setanta said he would follow as soon as he'd finished his game, proving that heroes of legend are every bit as dedicated to their games as our demigods at camp. Once Concobar was settled in at Cuculain's table, though, he entirely forgot to tell Cuculain that he'd invited Setanta, who'd be arriving a little later. Cuculain thus unchained his hound, a massive guard dog the size of a pony, to protect his house. When Setanta arrived, the guard dog attacked him and would have torn him to pieces. But Setanta killed the dog in self-defense, thinking it was a mythical beast ready to devour him. He felt terrible when he realized it had been Cuculain's dog, and he offered to guard Cuculain's house in the dog's place until a pup could be raised and trained to resume its father's job. A druid, listening to Setanta making this offer, said that from now on, that would be Setanta's name, Cuculain, literally meaning the Hound of Cuculain. At first, Setanta wasn't thrilled about that, but the druid assured him that one day, every man in the world would know the name Cuculain. Taking that as a challenge, Setanta accepted the change and became Cuculain. Every night for the next year, he walked the perimeter around Cuculain's house, then lay down in front of the door to sleep like a dog with one eye open, guarding Cuculain's property. That story always makes me a bit sad. I hate it when animals get hurt, even in stories. But it does show us how important guard dogs were in Celtic culture. It also reminds me a little bit of a moment in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, featuring one of our modern heroes.
Indiana. We named the dog Indiana.
Demigods, have you ever named a pet after a mythical figure? We'd love to hear about it and see pictures. You can send them to us with Immortal Guardian's help and permission through the link in our show notes. I don't know about you, demigods, but this episode gave me the warm fuzzies. I'm off to go cuddle my furry friends. Our next episode will be a back-to-school special. Until then, thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're enjoying Myths and Muses, please leave us a rating and a review on your platform of choice. Myths and Muses is brought to you by Plato Learning. Since 2010, Plato Learning has remained steadfast in our quest to turn stories over to the imaginations of young people who infuse them with energy, power, and ingenuity, reminding us all how and why we fall in love with reading and storytelling. To learn more about our summer camps, Camp Half-Blood, Camp Jupiter, Daring Girls, and Camp Mythic, or about Mytho, our tabletop role-playing game, please visit plato-learning.com or find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, demigods, stay brave out there.